truthfully, what happens is, as children grow up, we start to educate them progressively from the waist up. And then we focus on their heads, and slightly to one side.
I think in the old days, you know, you were better off. Because nowadays, they're all specialists. Everyone's becoming better and better, and less and less. And eventually, someone's going to be superb at nothing.
Our education system has mined our minds in the way that we've strip-mined the earth for a particular commodity. And for the future, it won't serve us. We have to rethink the fundamental principles on which we're educating our children.
We're not here to tell everybody that they're wrong and we're right. We're not saying that we have all the answers, but we'd like to present a different way of looking at it.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to China Jedication, Episode 7. My name is Sean Thomas Maroney, and I am the leading learner at QSI, that's Quality School International, Zhuhai. And I will be sharing with you some of my adventures and musings today.
Excellent. And as always, thank you for coming on as another guest on China Jedication, Sean. Mr. Sean Moran, wouldn't it be?
Sean's fine with me.
Do your students call you Mr. Moran? Because a lot in China, they don't tend to use the surnames, do they? Sometimes for pronunciation's sake. Do they call you Mr. Moran, Mr. M?
They call me Mr. Sean.
Okay. Which is kind of funny, isn't it? People call me Mr. Chris. It's like, no, it's not my name, but where is my name?
Only the Mr. part.
Yeah. Yes. Mr. Men. Great books, weren't they? I used to love reading those.
Indeed.
Now I read them to my children, and I'm like, I never knew they were so damn long.
Especially at bedtime.
Yes. You want shorter stories at bedtime. Now, you said leading learner. Let's start with that, because, yeah, where did that come from?
It comes from the proposition that, for me, the art and craft of teaching, and I do consider it a craft, has to stand on the foundation that I am always learning and not just teaching. And that's what truly informs my teaching practice and craft.
Okay, wonderful. Nicely said. So in terms of what you're doing now at QSI, though, what would be your position? Because you're in a room, you're a homeroom teacher of grade...
Well, it's grade 6. The QSI method, if you will, goes by groupings according to age, not so much, the form of numbers. So it's about stage and age. In this case, it's more emphasis on the age than the stage.
Right. Age and stage, but more stage.
More age, maybe.
Okay. Right. And how long have you been at QSI for?
About a year and a half, actually.
Year and a half being in this particular QSI, or have you been at QSI before in other places? Of course, they've got schools all over the world.
They do indeed. I made my start here in Zhuhai, and here I've been for about 1.5 years.
Okay.
I started in not this January, but the one previous, so ergo the half a year, so 1.5 years.
But is this the first time working in the QSI school?
It is.
Right, yeah. Okay. And before that, were you also in China before the QSI? I thought you were in a different part of China.
That's true. I've been in China off and on for some years. I first came to China in a similar role, working as an educator. At that particular time, it was in Qingdao, which is Shandong province,
yeah.
Up in the northeast.
The old German bastion.
For a little while, sure, it was a colonial so-called bastion of what was then the Kaiser's Germany.
Yeah. They brought the brewing process, didn't they, which was, I'd say, a very positive thing.
Yep, they did, and they've sort of maintained it, and interestingly, just business thing, it's kind of gone back, because now Heineken's the major shareholder. Unless the Chinese have bought out Heineken recently.
Well, I'm sure that's more than possible.
That's possible.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know.
Heinechen, I think they're calling it. Sorry. Yeah. No, moving on. So Qingdao before. Qingdao before and before Qingdao.
Before that, I worked in the Middle East, in Egypt.
Teaching?
Living and teaching.
Oh, whoa. And how long for in the Middle East?
3 years.
In?
Cairo, Al-Qahira.
Cairo?
Yes.
What, in Egypt? Okay.
Yes, yes.
I've often wondered, do they have a school in Egypt that's in a pyramid? Now, I'm not joking here, not in one of the old ancient pyramids, but has someone come along and gone, hey, I got loads of cash, let's just, I don't know why I'm saying it in an American accent, but, you know, let's build a school in a pyramid.
Well, I suppose if you consider a biblioteca school of sorts, you could say yes, because the Alexandria Library rebuild consisted of a major portion of its
pyramid. Okay, so the library. So
that was sort of the idea that it would become a depository of learning, or a repository of learning is probably more appropriate.
Yes, yes. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but okay, so someone got
it was a bit of a depository when I was there. They were aiming, you know, aspiring to be a repository.
Yes.
So I absolutely no idea what it looks like now. But
let's keep going with this. So we're going back in time. So before Cairo, where were we?
I was a educator in my home state, and back in the United States of America. That was Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, yeah.
So Massachusetts area.
Okay, wonderful. And so what actually brought you to China then in the first place, Sean? You're in the Middle East. Did you go back to the States before you came to China? What was it that kind of flicked your Chinese switch?
I don't know. I wonder, because I've been overseas so long, these stories that I have to tell maybe seem less interesting to me than possibly do to others. But essentially, I've been overseas for almost 17 years, continually, and that journey began in late 2001, wherein I moved to Egypt to accept this sort of teaching challenge, and after that, it's been mostly in Asia, although we did work in Europe for 3 years as well. Prior to that, I was a Massachusetts educator, and what prompted this was all of my life, growing up with those Mr. Man plus bedtime stories. I sort of had the seed of adventure in me. My dad is originally a European. He's from Ireland. And when he was a very young man...
Which is where your name Moran obviously comes from there.
A little bit Irish in there, yep. He kind of made some choices and took his chances and went overseas. And in those days, it pretty much was a one-way ticket. It was a lot harder to move around the world in the 50s than now. Went out to sort of quest for his fortune in Canada, and then eventually made his way to the west coast of the United States and stayed there, and then met my mom, and, you know, as the cliche says, the rest is history. But I, too, share that sense of adventure. I'm kind of going back to my roots there, but even as a young boy, I'd hear the stories of Kipling or Stevenson or all those different classics, or I'd see photographs of the pyramids, just for example, or the Great Wall of China. And, you know, I was never satisfied just to hear the story and see the picture. I always wanted to be there and go there. So I sort of nourished this dream lifelong, and I kept maybe somewhere in my subconscious cultivating it, and then kind of determined that I didn't want to just, like, you know, do 6 days, seven nights. I wanted to, like, go and live there and experience the culture and hopefully give something back too, besides dollars. You know, I wanted to be able to actually participate in the culture and exchange. So, as well as having the experience, be able to offer something of my own too. And I found that through teaching, this might uniquely afford chances to do that, wherein not only am I experiencing the culture by interacting and living with the people, in some cases the kids and families, but hopefully I'm able to give something back and leave a legacy as well.
So, okay, marvelous. So that picture of the Great Wall of China, that was what attracted you to obviously come over to China from Cairo then, was it? It was the image of the Great Wall.
No, I wouldn't say it was one solid image. It was kind of more a place I hadn't been yet and another frontier.
Okay.
So, as opposed to a snapshot of Great Wall, maybe more the ongoing video of circumventing the globe and seeking out new places. And, you know, the more frontier, the more attractive it probably was to me, because I really was pretty adventurous in those days. And It wasn't, it had begun the process of like really opening, you know, already in the late 90s, but actually in 2002-03 when I first came here, it was still not as open as it is now. Mm-hmm. There was a lot less foreigners. When I moved to Qingdao in 2003, there was like probably 300 or 400 foreigners there, living there full time, in a city of 6 million.
Yeah,
so it was really a different experience culturally, and you know, not a day went by without stunned Chinese coming up, and if they could speak any English, they'd say, "You're the first foreigner I ever met."
Wow. Yeah, it really has changed so quickly.
Can I take a photo with you? And it's kind of celebrityhood just by presence. So it was a very different experience, and in a lot of ways, perhaps more challenging too. Different sorts of challenges, but I definitely felt like I made the right choices. I was always happy and interested to be there, and I can look back now and say that truly I feel like I was part of a lot of historical moments.
Okay, well, you're going to make history being on the China Jedi as well, Mr. Moran, so let's continue building this brick wall and hopefully get a few more questions out of the way. So, bring you down to Zhuhai. In comparison to Qingdao, are you enjoying your time in Zhuhai as a teacher as opposed to Qingdao? More so, what's your...
It's kind of hard to compare because I'm in such a different place. Mm. So is China.
Let me rephrase it. Are you happier having a better time in Zhuhai or than in Qingdao?
Different time.
Okay. But I hope both of them are happy then.
Yeah, you know, I mean, where that life were so simple, happy, sad. I think it's more often gradations of two. I'll strive for contentedness, and if I can have that, then...
Contentedness.
Yeah.
So in terms of QSI Zhuhai, obviously quite a small school here.
Indeed.
You have a grade 6 class.
Yes.
Although you said, it was more about age than stage. But in terms of your teaching experience, have you always done this kind of age group, or have you kind of done different age groups?
Majority of the time has been with middle and high schoolers,
okay.
So teenagers generally. This is a little bit on the younger side.
And what type of, what age group do you really like to focus on more so in your experience, Sean?
I think I'm probably a good fit for teenagers, probably, like some of those lovely middling years. Essentially, probably 12 to 17.
Okay.
I kind of made a specialty of middle school only because so many people do not want to do it, and sort of found a bit of a niche because I am willing to do it. And
the hormonal years.
Yeah, I think there's a unique energy that comes with middle school. Yeah. It can be an incredibly challenging age too, and certainly you have your moments, but if you can channel that energy in the right way, and I use the word channel purposefully because I think a lot of teachers run into issues when they try to control that age, and immediately they get some pushback or attitude or whatever, and it can be unpleasant to try to get your job done with. But if you channel the energy that kids have that at that age and kind of like maybe point the way, give them some direction, you can really do a lot of really magical things and empower them and learn a lot in the process.
The subjects that you've taught, have you kind of focused on just like a couple, or have you done lots of types of stuff? I mean, let's go to middle school, for example, high school. What were you teaching there predominantly?
I'm an arts and science sort of guy.
Okay.
So that is to say I'm comfortable in a number of different subject matters. For a long time, I did a really strong focus on like arts and literature. And then because of my own avocations, interests in astronomy and the natural world and such, I started getting into technology and kind of got swept up in the whole digital revolution of the 90s.
Like would you call yourself a techie? Not a Trekkie, by the way. Did I say that wrong? Techie.
A technology refugee.
Yes.
Recovering techie.
Yes.
Digital refugee, maybe.
Digital refugee, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I worked as a technologist in education for many years, and that was kind of my mantle for that time. And I think the mission that we had in mind was to really help kind of hyper-connect the world of education and get people in a place where they were able to have a variety of different means for expression and creation and collaboration. And I feel that largely we kind of we've done that. I feel like we've pretty much arrived in terms of the modern school room for being able to do that. So I've stepped away from it a little bit and kind of gone back to my roots, like pure learning and teaching, a lot less technology and more focused on the content. Yeah.
Hmm. And I saw a list. I shouldn't really say this, but I was privy to a list. I don't know if it's a secret list of the staff that have been using the most paper in the printers and photocopiers, because they toll it up here, don't they? You know, everyone has an account.
All schools, yeah.
Yeah, and I can't remember who were the top three. Were you in the top three, Sean, for that list?
No.
He shakes his head in front of us, listeners.
No, because I'm the one who helped put that list in place. So.
You've gone I'm really in the inside.
Yeah.
You've gone so old school now, you just use chalk and you wipe it off afterwards. Or slates and stones.
I print when I have to, but... I don't think we have to as much as we probably believe we do.
Yeah, paper schmaper, huh?
One of the things I worked towards this year was empowering the kids to be able to have, again, a variety of means for expression and creation and collaboration. So I basically started a sort of ipso facto one-to-one program inside this classroom. So now all the kids have their own computers or devices. And an awful lot of the work that you might do through kind of paper chasing can be done digitally. That is not to say I have the quote digital classroom per se. I still very much believe in hard copy. You'll see a lot of books and things of that ilk around still, but no I do not print out loads and loads of paper. I am concerned about the environmental aspect of it, and also I just think there's a consumer consciousness that comes with just print. If you are kind of accustomed to having that at hand, you may not think so much about it, but if you can, you should. The reason I know about the list is because despite my wanting to distance myself from the techie role...
Well, you've been playing an important part in the tech world here. Well, you've been doing talks and presentations and fixing this. And
I can't get away from it on my resume, and anyone who hires me always sees that and kind of has it in mind. And the fact is I kind of do have a pretty strong toolkit. Mm. And in a small school like this, as you will know, having done the work you've done here, we worn them one hat.
Yeah, worn them one hat.
So the onus is upon any of us to, if we can help, to help. And not a lot of other people have this skill. So I very often will help make technology, educational technology connections here if I can, because it needs to be done.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, very nice. Good attitude to have, isn't it? I think in an international environment.
I think it's essential.
Teaching style. What do you reckon? What's your teaching style?
Always learning.
Great. I'll tell you what. Let's keep up with those short answers. That's really nice. Moving on. Discipline, philosophy, or strategy? I mean, do you have a... the kids, from what I've seen, are quite good here.
Channel it.
Yeah. Channel them. Is that like a channeling as in from the ethers? Like channel, do some channeling or?
I'm sure there's probably some metaphysical connection, but I don't know what that is necessarily.
So do you have a strategy, a particular strategy that you're
using?
Yeah,
I do. And it's something that maybe is easier to do with older kids.
Right. Okay.
And that's to get the kids thinking and really become reflective about cause and effect.
Mm.
And when you can get them to do that, it becomes easier to help them take responsibility, because they start to see that they are the heirs of their own actions, and that will change and shape the way they approach things. Generally, there'll have to be some trial and error there. There will be, you know, some mistakes. I mean, everybody makes mistakes. It's part of learning. But I try to get the kids to think a little bit about how their actions are affecting.
Yeah.
Again, you know, making their choices and taking their chances.
How would that be? Would that be a kind of like a one-on-one dialogue, or would you give them like a reflective activity to do or something like that? What's your toolbox there that you'd usually go to?
That's an important question and a really good one, because there's quite a few different ways that can look. And what I've given you is it's a very nice sounding answer, but how does that look in reality? A lot of teachers would probably want to know that too. And I think it really depends on the chemistry and the ability of the class.
Yeah.
these are things that you have to phase in. It's not like you start the first day and then, wow, everyone is suddenly a self-deterministic learner.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't work that way necessarily. Especially in schools like this where you're going to have kids with a very wide range of well, any school, not just this one, a wide range of different language ability and personal focus and proficiency. So what I've done is use different techniques that I hope will help them understand the way their minds and their bodies work. We do mindfulness. We have a curriculum that we have implemented here where we get kids to kind of slow down.
It's in the curriculum, is it?
In my curriculum.
Your curriculum, yeah.
So that's okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. And enrichment.
Yeah, and it's... I actually offer it to the whole school, and it's been sanctioned, if you will, by the powers that be. But what we're trying to do is help kids understand that there's an awful lot of choice that goes into, you know, what they do, and that can be really empowering. And likewise, you can learn from mistakes where maybe you didn't examine all those choices. Routines are good at this age. Kids need structure, a lot of them, and if you can provide a consistent structure and have conversations with them about why they're learning what they're learning, I find that that's empowering too. Even if they're not used to it, if kids have a sense of purpose when they approach a task and understand why it is that they're learning or why they might need to know, you know, what am I ever going to use this for?
Yeah.
I find that that can, I think that can empower their learning, and I think it can help them make the most of their experience in myriad ways. Lastly, I would say that a technique I use an awful lot with students is having them teach or co-teach what they know to others, be it kids, you know, in the younger grades or even on occasion to each other.
I like that. Yeah. But definitely not you couldn't certainly do that off the first day, could you, as you said. So something to think about there, listeners. Wonderful stuff. Okay, I want to go back in time to, I guess, when you were in Massachusetts growing up. What was your school life like? Could you paint a picture? Where did you go to school when you were young? Was it one place, a small place? Massachusetts is quite big, isn't it?
New England is, and that's a grouping of states. I think my school experience was pretty idyllic until like grade 5.
Okay, what happened?
And then after that, it was pretty not ideal.
You changed school or...?
I think just my attitude about learning and being able to, again, make choices. I found it very stressful, and I felt the shift from a strong relationship-based type of opportunities to learn and work together towards like far more content-driven. That was really hard for me. I didn't really understand it. And we had things happening too in my family and at home that just kind of exacerbated that.
Right.
And I just can't help going back to what we were just talking about, which is that an awful lot of what any teacher does, I believe, is really dependent on relationships. And I think a teacher's primary role, if they want to improve their teaching craft or skill, is to really work on developing relationships with students. I think that that's ongoing, it's lifelong, and you're never finished with that. And I think it's really key, I think it's essential. And I had off and on, you know, positive or less so relationships with teachers, and some of them, really shaped who I am in some very positive ways, and other ways made the trip a little bit more challenging for me. I detested high school, the lack of choice, the sort of impending sense of doom about having to join the world, and all these existential kind of anxious scenarios we were supposed to entertain every day. What college are you going to go to? And if you're not going to uni, where are you going? And you're going to... And a very binary sort of outlook.
Yeah.
And also I grew up in a different time when the world was in some ways more simpler, but in other ways more complex. You know, it was still the Cold War and still a lot of sort of looming uncertainty about the future, which we still have. But, you know, I don't know. I guess I think for me, it's almost ironic to end up as a school teacher, because it would, if you had asked me in high school what I was going to be, it would have been the very last thing I would have chosen.
I'd say exactly the same about myself, Sean. High school, then on to university. What did you do at college or university?
Most of my uni years were spent at Amherst in Massachusetts,
okay.
University of Massachusetts.
Did you study?
Amherst. I also studied at a little while in University of Hawaii as well.
What were you doing? You study?
In both cases, I was studying both arts and science,
okay.
Both natural sciences and later education. And my mainstay in Amherst was like, let's see, okay, I have a history degree, I've got a, with a minor in natural studies, I have an education degree with a minor in theater, I've got a master's degree in technology.
You're hot, you're really got a lot of degrees.
It's just paper.
Yeah.
I'm still learning.
You mentioned you had a bit of a rocky patch, lots of things, life comes and goes, and but you said you had some positive relationships. Everyone, they say, has a favourite teacher. Do you, one in particular that comes to mind, just from your
subconscious? I think back to the earliest days, which is a good place to start.
You're now one.
Miss Davis, probably.
Miss Davis.
I still remember her. Yeah, in fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
Yeah.
What was great about Miss Davis?
Well, you know, she really saw you. She valued you for who you were, and she reaffirmed that. And with that supported this wonderful belief that I think parents at least set out to try to inculcate in children, which is they can be or do anything they want in the world.
Yeah.
That starts to fade pretty quickly when you get into a school environment, doesn't it? Potentially.
Now I know from a little bird that this is your last year at QSI. You're embarking...
QSI Juhai.
Sorry, my coughing. QSI Juhai. You're embarking on another QSI to another place. So you're moving from China. Now, I want to wrap this into my next question, which is, what's been your biggest challenge, would you say, teaching in China, in international school? And is that something that you won't miss? Or one of the reasons why, you know, you decided to move all the way over to, it's Trinidad and Tobago, am I right?
Yeah.
Trinidad and Tobago, which of course in the West Indies,
yep.
Caribbean. Yeah, so the biggest challenge and the reason for your move, which is, you know, to be congratulated.
Oh, thanks, yeah. Well, this move's really more about to than from.
Okay.
So, you know, actually going back to as opposed to leaving or escaping.
So it's the next step back home, basically.
Yeah. As I said, I've been overseas 16 years.
Full circle, they say.
Yeah, it's true. I haven't really spent a lot of time in Central or South America, so kind of looking forward to that. That will be like pretty much everywhere except from Antarctica.
I've
really seen the world at that point. Mind you, that's not the only reason to go. It's just time, I feel. Biggest challenge... I'm not sure I totally understood the question. Do you mean about Asia and China or about...
Yeah, teaching in China, what's been a big challenge for you?
I suppose that the biggest challenge is that we are... we're here and with entertaining the idea that we're going to bring a Western perspective and again sort of empower kids with the necessary skills to succeed in a Western or international context anyways. And as you know, having grown up in it yourself, we come from a world where, contextually speaking, critical inquiry is kind of our bread and butter. You know, kids are encouraged to ask questions from the start. And, you know, I'm sure you're very conscious of the Western tradition, and it comes down from the whole Socratic legacy of inquiry, asking questions and challenging things and debating and wrestling with it. And in the East, that's just not so. It's a very different paradigm. So you have kids that have a difficult time with this process, and they're very good at sort of learning how to do certain things. But if you ask them to you know, the why they're learning it, or to sort of extrapolate upon that and innovate, if you ask them to reflect upon it, some of them, or many of them, find that tremendously difficult. And the way that might manifest in an everyday way, give you the sort of short sum, you've got, whatever, 18 kids in front of you, you go to ask a question about, you know, XYZ, whatever it might be, and you get dead silence.
Yeah, dead silence.
And you try even more, you know, with a laugh to entertain and, you know, become a catalyst for provoking thought or some sort of discussion, and you still get nothing but what appears to be absolute passivity. Mm. And the only thing more challenging than a class of hyperactive, you know, naughty, sort of onset, you know, is fresh kind of cheeky monkey little kids is a class that's completely passive, because that's exhausting.
Yeah.
As exhausting, but in a different way, because they give you nothing. They're both exhausting, and they're both, you know, not really fulfilling personally as a teacher. They're both really, really challenging, but it's a whole different thing. And if you've not been, if you're not used to that, that can be a, you might never get used to it.
Yeah, but in a nutshell though, Shaw, what you're going on about earlier about, you know, a fundamental key part of teaching in the past and the present is relationship.
Yes.
Have you found that developing the relationship with how we would say these more passive students helps to bring that out, you know, it catalyzes them to speak up a bit and to critically. Have you found that in your experience?
Yeah. But of course.
Okay.
Because you have to make them feel safe with that process. They're not just going to take your word for it. And I've watched kids even in this class here this year come a long, long way.
Right.
I've got children in this class that wouldn't speak a word no matter what you did for the first, literally the first 6 months of this year, and now they will raise their hands, they'll volunteer answers, they'll take chances, they'll say things that they might not be right about, and they know that. That's huge for them, taking that sort of risk. So that's very, very gratifying, and it's very vindicating as a teacher.
Good
and
stuff.
It's validating for both them and for me.
Well, before you hop off to Trinidad and Tobago, we've got to end, as always, with a teacher's tip. A recipe for success if you want to compete. Right then, Shaw, I'm sure you got absolutely thousands of tips. We'd love to hear them all, but of course, you're going to have to pick your golden nugget. So, a tip to all those educators out there today who may be in China, maybe thinking of coming to China, what would it be?
I would say, this is going to sound redundant, but I would say, to best teach, always be open to learning.
And I think on that, we will end. Thank you very much for coming in, Shaw.
You're entirely welcome, and thanks for having me.
If you enjoy listening to the China Jedi podcast and want to get involved, either by asking a question, expressing your opinion, good or bad, light or dark, or even appearing as a special guest, then get in touch by emailing our team at info@chinajedi.com. That's info@chinajedi.com.
May the smile be with you.